It's Friday, March 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry meets with Belgian authorities to discuss this week's terror attacks in Brussels. We'll hear how dog domestication has changed the course of history, and a comic book exhibition in London shows the evolution of Batman and Superman. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel Friday to deliver condolences after Tuesday's terror attacks and to offer U.S. support towards Belgium's investigation and future counterterrorism efforts. Meanwhile, authorities are pursuing suspects thought to be involved in the attacks in the Belgian capital. I spoke on the line with VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch in Brussels.
Well, we've heard that overnight that there were raids in several parts of Brussels and six suspects were arrested. We don't have very much information about who they are or if they are actually being formally charged with anything. There was a story earlier in the week about somebody who was arrested and then later it became clear he was either released or were never arrested in the first place. One thing that some analysts are talking about is that it appears that going forward, we're going to see a lot of arrests that may or may not be prove fruitful because the security forces obviously are very concerned and looking to find the guys. And as of now, they have identified three of the bombers that have been killed. They are looking for one or possibly two that have not been identified.
And then I believe, in addition, there have been some criticisms of Belgium authorities about how they are, you know, how they have handled this whole thing, the investigation. And apparently both Belgium's justice and interior minister offered to resign, that those resignations were rejected by the country's prime minister, Charles Michel.
Yes, he did reject their offers of resignation, and there has been quite a bit of criticism about, not exactly about how it's been handled after the bombings, but about what led up to the bombing. Two of the bombers were well known to, or not well known to the Belgian police, but known, and one was on a list suspected of terrorism through Interpol. Another guy was in Turkey. He was deported from Turkey for trying to join Islamic State fighters in Syria. The Turkish authorities arrested him and sent him to Holland and sent an email, apparently, explaining the situation. That could have been an opportunity for authorities to detain him, and it might have prevented at least some of this tragedy. But one of the problems here in Brussels is that the way the city is governed is it's split up into different areas called communes, and they each have their own police force. So there's a lot of disjointedness in the security forces here. And there's also two distinct languages. A lot of people either speak French or Flemish, but they don't necessarily speak both. So it's hard for people to coordinate anything in this country.
In the aftermath of the attacks, have you observed how are people handling this? Or is security been stepped up?
Security has been stepped up. Not something that's as prevalent on the streets as it was, say, in November when this threat first came to light. At that time, there was army everywhere. Now it's less so, but people are frightened, and I don't know that more police on the streets is going to make them less frightened. Certain areas, like the train station, has army surrounding it. I don't know. It's a strange thing because people here want more security and they want to be safe, but they're also really concerned about becoming a police state. They don't want that. They think that, or at least what people have told me is that I think too much security is as dangerous as not enough sometimes.
That's VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch in Brussels. Magnus Ranstorp is the research director for threat studies at the Swedish Defense University in Stockholm. I asked him about the criticism of Belgian authorities for perceived security lapses, with more evidence of links between the Paris attacks in November and this week's strikes in Brussels.
I think Belgium is in a tough spot. It has a federal system with lots of bureaucracy. You have six different police districts just in Brussels. You have different administrative units trying to coordinate, which is not easy. They have been focusing on the issue, but they're a relatively small security service. They have 470 foreign fighters that have gone off to Syria, some have come back. Their geographic position also means that there is an operational belt of extremists stretching from Molenbeek to Paris, which switches back and forth. We've seen that. The weapons in Charlie Hebdo came from Belgium. The Thalys high-speed train attacker came from Verviers in eastern Belgium. You know, so sometimes they plan and operate across borders, and maybe there is not enough coordination between the French intelligence, which is a huge service, and the smaller Belgian ones. I think also the Belgians are, should we say, handicapped by the fact that Belgium is also the transit point for trafficking in human beings and drugs and weapons. So you have everything. It's a cocktail of lots of different issues and problems. So I think to that extent, it's a very difficult environment to police. I think what the mistake that the Belgian service have done is that it doesn't have enough human sources, infiltrators within these environments. It's also compounded by the fact that they have not enough prevention efforts. So they only rely on repression, police intelligence. And if that's not bad enough, the terrorists themselves have moved towards encryption in the communication, which makes some of the security services half blind in trying to follow the different connections. So I think it's sort of like a perfect storm of different weather fronts that come together that had made Belgium so vulnerable.
Looking at the security situation for Europe and certainly North America and other parts of the world in general, looking at these attacks, you know, how in the future do you think authorities can try to prevent this by places like airports and subway systems?
Well, the UK have been dealing with this, of course, for a long time. There are technologies that can be used in terms of at least explosives to be able to detect explosives being brought down into the subway systems, etc. So there are technical solutions. You can also move out the perimeter. You also need to have some personnel that is ready to be able to, if there is an active shooter, to take them on very quickly. I think it depends. I think, you know, it always begins within the nation state. So what they need to do is to, first of all, invest in adequate security resources for the intelligence and security personnel. They simply are, for example, in Belgium, there isn't enough of them. There also needs to be greater cooperation, particularly bilaterally between different countries, to be able to follow some of these networks. But there are larger issues as well. The issue of identity theft is a huge one. For example, there are 177,000 Swedish passports on the loose, either stolen or lost. There are 400,000 German ID documents and passports that are on the loose as well. So getting greater biometrics, also, of course, passenger national or name records needs to be focused in on. It's a huge issue they're discussing in the EU and the Brussels. It is compounded by the fact of the refugee issue of vetting people. Do we know who they are? Of course, there are very small numbers only who would maybe have an extremist or terrorist connection, but we also need to have those systems. We also need to tackle the trafficking in illegal weapons. The Balkans is one area where there's a lot of activity on this front. So there's a lot of different areas where there's a great need for improvement.
Magnus Ranstorp, Research Director for Threat Studies at the Swedish Defense University. Well, joining me on the line is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, the sad news that we're hearing this morning and regarding the Brussels attacks is the names Alexander and Sasha Panshavsky. These were two Americans who were killed in the attack. Their brother and sister were in the airport in the line for Delta Airlines when the bomb exploded. And in the days after the attack, their friends and family were using social media to try to locate them. There was initially, they didn't know where they were. They thought they may have been injured. So they were tweeting out and saying, if you have any information, please let us know. And unfortunately got word that they had died in those attacks. But again, showing that social media has been a valuable tool for people in the aftermath to try to find family members, locate people, connect with people.
All right. Anything else trending?
Well, the other big trending topic today is Good Friday. Of course, one of the, if not the most the sacred day in the Christian religious calendar. And as people are preparing to celebrate Easter this Sunday, they're celebrating Good Friday today. And among them is Pope Francis. Now, Pope Francis just joined Instagram this week, timely, because now he's posting pictures, or his people at the Vatican are posting pictures of him doing various things in preparation for Easter. Yesterday on Holy Thursday, one of the things that he does every year is wash the feet of different people, as Jesus did in the Bible. And this year he was washing the feet of migrants, of men and women, which is women usually aren't part of this ritual. But he was posting all of that to Instagram and Twitter, so a lot of people around the world sharing those images. And then, of course, Happy Easter also trending in preparation for Sunday. But a lot of religious sentiment being expressed throughout social media today, tomorrow, and into Sunday.
Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Music has the power to transcend barriers of language and culture and the ability to stir deep human emotion. A group of Finnish researchers has found that it's not only the music itself, but also where you listen to it that can influence its emotional impact. Previous scientific research suggests that emotional reaction to music can be gauged by physical responses, such as changes in the electrical properties of the skin. With this in mind, the researchers played a selection of a Beethoven symphony as it would be heard in different concert halls to a group of test subjects. The scientists from Aalto University attached sensors to the subjects' fingers, which measured these electrical changes as they listened to the music under the varied acoustic conditions. The researchers found that music played in the acoustical environment of shoebox-type or rectangular concert halls produced the strongest emotional reaction in the listeners than other hall designs. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a comic book exhibit in London. Well, now we hear the story about the evolutionary split between wolves and dogs. Scientists don't yet agree on when and where that happened. But as VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, some research points to this separation as the springboard for the evolution of modern civilization.
Thousands of dogs from 50 states and a dozen foreign countries compete each year in the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show, the second largest continuous sporting event in the United States. A new breed in 2015 was the wired hair Vizsla. Among them was Izzy, whose owner, Mark Goodwine, said his coppery canine has what it takes to win.
I think he's very much a quality animal and has just as much chance for a best in show as any of the other dogs entered here.
The Vizsla is one of nearly 200 breeds accredited by the American Kennel Club, a number that has grown through centuries of selected breeding. At the beginning, though, there was only one, the common ancestor of dogs and wolves.
Previous studies have estimated that this common ancestor lived about 10 to 15,000 years ago.
In his laboratory at the Swedish Natural History Museum, zoologist Love Dahlén holds a Taimyr wolf bone fragment he discovered on an expedition to Siberia. He says it shows wolves have a genetic history on the Taimyr Peninsula dating back to the last ice age.
This wolf belonged to the population that was the last known common ancestor between wolves and dogs. And therefore, we have to revise the timing of the split between wolves and dogs to at least 30,000 years ago. So this indicates that dogs were actually domesticated already some 30,000 years ago, which is about twice as long ago as people have previously thought.
But did domestication and the evolutionary split happen at the same time? Gregor Larson at the University of Oxford wants more proof.
Which could be interpreted as domestication, except for that there's the possibility, strong possibility, I would argue, that modern dogs didn't descend from that lineage of wolves. So that most recent common ancestor isn't dating domestication. It's just saying, when was it that modern dogs and that particular wolf shared a common ancestor, and that may well could have predated domestication by, you know, any number of years.
He and colleagues worldwide are collecting thousands of ancient bone and DNA samples for a massive database.
In an effort to try and actually watch that process happen of dogs becoming wolves, the spread of both genetic and morphometric signatures across time and space.
Dogs were the first domesticated animal. Larson believes that occurred several thousand years before human society shifted from hunter-gatherer to settled agriculture, which researchers say happened around 10,000 years ago in many parts of the world. Larson says the domestication of the dog changed the course of civilization.
So really what it does is it kicks off this very new way that humans have of relating to the natural world. And there's an argument that says if you don't have dogs, then there's a chance that the whole idea of domestication doesn't form for quite a while after that. And it delays anything else that's happened after that, or it makes it not even possible necessarily.
Larson expects to release a major study in the near future and others with his collaborators over the next several years. Using the common data. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. The new movie Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, has two of the comic world's heroes facing off in an epic conflict. International Edition's David Byrd tells us that a rare collection of the original comic books that gave birth to the characters is on display in London.
If the name Ayman al-Hariri sounds familiar, it should. He is the billionaire son of assassinated former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik al-Hariri. He is also the owner of The Impossible Collection, featuring first editions of Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman comics. Some of the books are valued at $1 million each. Each of the clear displays in the exhibit features the comics behind special protective cases arranged like shelves in order to show them off. There are special lights to showcase the comics without damaging them. Visitors can look at Detective Comics number 27, the first time Batman appeared, or Sensation Comic number 1, the first cover of Wonder Woman. There is also a 1938 copy of the first issue of Action Comics, which featured the first appearance of Superman. Less than 100 of the comics exist in the world, and Hariri has two of them. The billionaire construction magnate says he is not worried about his collection being exposed to the public.
I think people have a respect for these books and the characters that they represent. I really wanted the design of the display to allow people to get as close as possible to them.
Many of the original issues came out just before World War II, when the world was still struggling in the Depression and the Nazis were rising to power in Germany. Hariri says that the artwork and even the ads in the books show people the turbulent times.
To really see just what the world was like at that time when the book came out. Each book has a very good representation of what was going on in the world at the time. So I wanted that to be clear. And even the ads are amazing on the back. They're fantastic.
The 37-year-old Hariri says that he has been collecting the books for 16 years since he was 11. He kept the comics in boxes and did not get to see them in their entirety. Hariri says that he was especially drawn to the Superman comics after seeing an illustration of his late father.
When I went back home, after not being there for a while, I noticed a picture of my father drawn as Superman. It's actually in the gallery here. And he's carrying schools and universities above the torn Lebanon below him.
Ayman al-Hariri says after his father's death, he collected as many Superman books as he could get his hands on. He says of all the heroes featured in the exhibit, his father is his greatest hero because in real life, he chose to do good things. The Impossible Collection is open at London's St. Pancras Hotel and features more than 1,000 original comics from Hariri's collection. The billionaire businessman says he wants to share his collection with the world, but for now, the exhibit is not traveling. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns in the strongest possible terms the outrageous terrorist attacks in Israel and Jerusalem, which tragically took the life of American Taylor Allen Force and left many others severely injured. Mr. Force, a U.S. veteran who had served tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, was stabbed by a Palestinian on the Jaffa boardwalk by the Mediterranean. The last 5 months have seen a spate of Palestinian attacks on Israeli civilians and security forces. These attacks have consisted mainly of stabbings, but also shootings and car rammings. On a recent visit to Israel, Vice President Joe Biden denounced those in the international community and in the Palestinian Authority who have failed to condemn Palestinian terrorist attacks against Israel. Let me say in no uncertain terms, the U.S. condemns these acts and condemns the failure to condemn these acts. He also said the rhetoric that incites that violence, the retribution that it generates, has to stop. Such violence cannot be accepted, said Vice President Biden. This cannot be viewed by civilized leaders as an appropriate way to behave. It is just not tolerable in the 21st century. Palestinian terrorists are targeting innocent civilians, mothers, pregnant women, grandfathers, and American citizens, said Vice President Biden. There can be no justification for this violence. The U.S. stands firmly behind Israel's right to defend itself, said Vice President Biden. U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby said, "We continue to encourage all parties to take affirmative steps to reduce tensions and restore calm."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.